Welcome to Whistleblower Network News. I am your host, Jane Turner, FBI whistleblower and advocate. It is our honor to share with you these experiences of real-life heroes and people of integrity. Hello, this is Jane Turner with Whistleblower of the Week, and I am an FBI whistleblower advocate, and host of this program. I'm really excited today to have Jeremiah Johnson on. I've been chasing after Jeremiah, Dr. Johnson, for a long time, and I finally have him on this program. He's a conscientious law enforcement leader. Dr. Johnson has served in a variety of sworn and civilian roles across the criminal justice system, including policing, sentencing, and corrections. He's got a decade of teaching experience, delivering courses at the undergraduate or graduate level in criminology, criminal justice, police administration, leadership, public administration, and just a plethora of different things in the justice administration. He holds a BA in sociology from Geneva College and a master's in justice administration from Western Connecticut State University, and a master's in criminal justice from John Jay College, my old alma mater.
I didn't know that.
Yes, I went to John Jay. And a PhD, this is why we're calling him Dr. Johnson, in criminal justice from the City University of New York Graduate Center. His dissertation research focused on the role of relational networks in diffusing law enforcement innovations. Now, Dr. Johnson, we're going to get to what that is in plain English a little later into this, but I really am interested in two things. So sure. We'll have two things going in this interview, and welcome. The first thing is your whistleblowing. I know you have not had the freedom to discuss it prior. This is why we have waited so long to get you on this program. Could you speak to that, please? And then we're going to talk about the organization, a nonprofit that you founded, which is just exceptional. But let's start with your whistleblowing, first of all. Tell us how this came about and where you were at.
Certainly, Jane. Well, thank you for having me on this podcast of yours. I think it's a wonderful thing. And we've worked a long time together behind the scenes to highlight law enforcement whistleblowers. So I really thank you for your partnership in doing that. One of the things I really wanted to do was to call attention to the courage of whistleblowers coming from that field of law enforcement, which we share. So I had a 20 plus year career in municipal policing. I was hired by a municipality in Fairfield County, Connecticut, back in 2002. And I was able to retire just last year. I think I'm coming up on the anniversary, February 1st, of my retirement.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And just in that time, I've become more what I call public facing regarding my role with Lamplighter Project and just speaking about my own experiences in policing when it comes to calling out wrongdoing, whether that be criminal misconduct or other wrongs or harms in the system, and trying to support other people who have come forward. The term whistleblower is one that I have an uncomfortable relationship with, at least for me personally, because in my own experiences, I never went outside of my own organization. Perhaps in hindsight, I should have, but I also realized that that likely would have resulted in the end of my law enforcement career. I did what I was supposed to as far as following the chain of command. Or in sometimes jumping the chain of command in order to report criminal misconduct on a couple of occasions that I had come across in the course of my duties. And unfortunately, it happened across my career at a couple different levels and emerged in different ways. I went into the field of policing somewhat naively, thinking that I would not have to engage with some of these ethical dilemmas, right? Because I was joining the good guys, right? I had I had studied philosophy and some other classes in college, and I hadn't deeply considered that possibility. I think perhaps I should have thought of it more deeply, but I think I saw things in a very black and white type of manner, you know, good guys, bad guys, and I was joining the good guys. Law enforcement, I describe it as a very seductive field. You know, you get to do a lot of the exciting things. They often say in this part of the country, you have a front row seat to the greatest show on earth. Mm-hmm. And I think it was very appealing to me. I didn't come from a law enforcement family. I didn't know much about the field other than maybe what I'd seen on TV, right? And so when I got into this agency, I was drawn very quickly to those officers who I felt were being really proactive and doing, you know, the exciting things. And so I would say I was early on very much headed down that road of quickly conforming to that that type of mentality and mindset in policing, and very much wanting to be part of that brotherhood. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the first times in which I encountered some misconduct in the course of my duties, I was actually not forthcoming. You know, and I think that's important to, you know, recognize and acknowledge. I was a rookie police officer working what we call the side job, an off-duty job, and there was an officer who had been out, what we called injured on duty, and was unable to work. And I was working essentially parking and security for a private event. And I saw him working in plain clothes at that same event. The officer basically said, you know, if I hear anything about this, I'll know who it came from. Uh-oh. And basically advised me to keep my mouth shut, which regrettably I did. You know, I do think I was feeling empathetic for his family. Maybe this guy needs money. Yes. Right. But he was also essentially defrauding the town.
Yes.
I did happen to confide in another officer who did the right thing. I don't know what his intentions were. I think he had some sort of beef with this particular officer and went right to the supervisor. So probably did the right things for the wrong reasons. Once that information had come to light, I actively participated in the investigation and wrote a statement. And since I was essentially the lone witness for that, the officer who had some disciplinary problems in their past was ultimately forced to resign. And that started a slow cascade of events in his life that ultimately led to him committing suicide a number of years later. And that tragedy, I think, just brought back the specter of, you know, my own involvement in that case, and that being what forced him out of law enforcement. So now, while nobody confronted me directly to my face on it, I think there were a lot of people who were still around who had remembered what had transpired, and it wasn't so much that his own conduct had ended his career, but you know, that I was the one that had brought those turn of events around. Even though initially, as I had said before, I had kept my mouth shut, as he had warned me to do. So I think that really taught me that the whole brotherhood in law enforcement, yes, really is a lie, And I've seen that play out countless times across the country with law enforcement whistleblowers who do speak up or out, even if it's just really to to save themselves, so to speak. You know, they're expected to cover for the misconduct of others. So going forward in my career, I think I was more ready to come out and confront wrongdoing, whether it was as a, you know, as a supervisor, or even holding other supervisors accountable, which happened several years later in my career. I think there was always the suspicion that I was out to get other cops, right? Wow. That I liked this part of the country, we call it getting jammed up.
Yes.
And I think there was a suspicion that I liked to jam up other people just because it happened a number of times in my career. Obviously, as a supervisor, you have a responsibility to hold other officers accountable for their jobs.
Yes.
But I never really went out looking for it, right? Trying to catch somebody. And for whatever reason, these things just happen to fall into my lap sometimes, or yes. I just happened to be working a shift where there was off-duty misconduct. And it actually caused me to, many years later, wonder whether I was just unlucky, right? If it was just bad luck that these things had happened to me, or was it that these things were happening to other officers and other supervisors that they were witnessing, and they were just covering them up. And I had spent some time going through, you know, counseling and things like that in response to all that I experienced, and received some affirmation that yes, in fact, there had been other misconduct that had transpired in the organization that was covered up by other officers. And I just had no knowledge of it because people didn't openly share that with me. I was very much on the outside when it came to that type of information.
Right.
So the next major incident that happened in my career, I was a brand new supervisor. We had done DWI checkpoints.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to this point in my career, there was, you know, nobody that we had always done just roaming patrols, but we got some, I don't know if it was grant money, but we started doing checkpoints. And I really enjoyed DWI enforcement. I believed in it and was quite good at it. And so I participated in these checkpoints. And one night, a young woman drove through the checkpoint, a young attorney. And asked her the standard questions, pulled her out for a field sobriety test, and which she failed, brought her back for processing and booking. We did our own booking and processed the arrest. I used the device used to collect blood alcohol samples. We called it an intoxilizer at that point in time. And, you know, gave her a court date and she was bonded out. Now, I think in part because she was an attorney and this could jeopardize her ability to practice law, she hired an attorney that specialized in DWI prosecution. And I was summoned to a hearing to testify. And I delivered that testimony. And I remember that the defense counsel had asked me to produce my certification to operate the machine. Mm-hmm. And it hadn't been listed on the list of items to produce. So the attorney basically said, you know, if you can produce this document, you don't have to reappear.
Oh.
And they had set a date. And, you know, a lot of these hearings are at really inconvenient times for a lot of officers,
yeah,
depending on shift work, right? And they might be at locations which are quite distant from your jurisdiction or where you live. So I was actually being somewhat lazy and not wanting to go back to the hearing. And I said, oh, well, I'll just get the document. The training sergeant at the time was actually on vacation, so I wasn't able to obtain the record, but these were all held with our state police because they managed the testing devices were actually theirs. They belong to the state police. So I said, oh, just reach out to the state police.
Yes.
So I got the, I made a phone call and they said that they would fax my record over to me. So I thought, great. And what came over the fax was not just my record, but the records of the entire department, right? I looked at the training record. The only time I had received training on this device was in the academy. So I thought it was just going to be my academy date from 6 years prior. But in fact, it was one from quite recently. So I speculated, well, perhaps I had made a DWI arrest and on that given day, and I had demonstrated proficiency with the machine just by using it. I checked my own personal records, hadn't made an arrest that day. I went down to the record of another officer and looked at his calendar and found out that that officer was not scheduled to work that day. I believe he might have been on vacation.
Oh.
And that was just I still remember the feeling, the sinking feeling that I had, because I realized that I had stumbled across something very serious.
Yes.
And in fact, the state had a law that officers, in fact, have to receive training on the machine on an annual basis. So I took that information up to, I think it was the number two in the department at the time, and basically said, you know, this just sort of blew up in my lap here.
Yes.
You know, I'll do whatever you want, but the one thing I'm not willing to do is lie.
Right.
They opened up an investigation. I did go back to that hearing, and I did in fact testify that I was not certified to operate the machine. And actually the hearing officer, I still have the record, actually commended me.
Yes.
For being truthful. And that I think was probably one of the proudest moments of my career, because I had done a difficult thing.
Yes.
That officer ultimately, that other supervisor was forced to resign. A forced retirement. But it never came to public light. I was told that it was brought to the chief state's attorney. Again, I was a new supervisor, still very much trusting in the agency to do the right thing.
Yes.
If I could go back, I, probably would have taken it further, because I did think it was a great injustice. It jeopardized a lot of cases, not just this one. I believe very firmly that we have to play by the rules.
And Doctor, sure. You were retaliated against, weren't you?
So when the training sergeant was forced to retire, there was a vacancy for that. I was a young sergeant. I was in a graduate program at the time, or I had just graduated with my first master's degree. I put in for that spot. And I was told directly that I could not be given that position because it would look bad, because I had gotten the prior sergeant fired.
Yes.
That was told in my face, that they couldn't do it. So in that sense, I believe that was a direct result of my role in reporting misconduct. So one of the things that I would say is, I never went outside of the agency. There were times that I absolutely felt fearful of my peers. While some of these investigations were going on and my name was mixed up in it, I remember circling my block, making sure that this fellow supervisor wasn't out to get me, so to speak. So there were definitely times in which I was fearful. But I would say that my experiences pale in comparison to those officers who have gone outside the agency. When you publicly embarrass an agency in that way, the full brunt of retaliation is brought to bear.
Yes.
Both in formal and informal ways. So I never speak about my own experiences that much, because I feel as though I only got a taste
Yes.
Of retaliation. You know, a lot of whispers and conjecture, and it definitely hurt my upward mobility, but in no way comes close to the retaliation experienced by many of the whistleblowers that I've come to know in doing this work. And so I felt very motivated to try and elevate these stories of other law enforcement whistleblowers and try to bring them to public light.
Right. Is that what Dr. Johnson, you know, kind of propelled you toward establishing the Lamplighter Project? And I know that's a favorite term of Francesco Serpico. So have you ever met with him, or is that where you came up with this concept because you had read something about him?
So, as I said before, I don't always consider myself a whistleblower. The term didn't always sit well with me. It wasn't until I read a speech by Frank Serpico where he mentioned the term lamplighter and actually referenced that as his preferred term over whistleblower. He gives a couple of stories about, you know, that term lamplighter, whether that be Paul Revere lighting the lamps to, mm-hmm. to warn people, or back from his old days in patrolling tenements and housing projects, when you turn on the lights, all the cockroaches scurry away.
Yes.
So when I read about that, the act of lamp lighting, that resonated with me and made me feel for the first time that what I had done inside my agency had value and was important, an important part of fulfilling my oath as a police officer and maintaining the integrity of the institution of policing. And so, yes, the term Lamplighter Project directly comes from the inspiration of Frank Serpico, not only his acts of reporting corruption in the New York City Police Department in the late 1960s and early 70s, but also just his continued activism. So, you know, he is somebody that I deeply admire and respect, as many whistleblowers do. I think they draw on his experience as a source of strength, as I did in my career. I think there's a feeling of a kinship, I think, with Frank Serpico, whether they've met him or not. You know, I've never met him in person, but I've had the fortune of having some long conversations with him on the telephone. So he's very much a mentor to me and continues to inspire a lot of our work with Lamplighter
yes.
Project.
Yes, I've had him on this program. He is
yes.
an interesting character and well beloved by many people. So that's how you came up with the Lamplighter Project. And yeah. I know that you have some impressive people on your board. Austin Handel, I know very well, and it's a great guy. Sarah, Peace Corps volunteer, whistleblower, incredible person. So you just have put together an incredible organization.
Well, thank you. I'm very blessed for them to have dedicated their time and talents to moving forward our collective mission. The Lamplighter Project really just started out as an anonymous Twitter account. As I mentioned before, I was seeking to elevate the stories of law enforcement whistleblowers. So that started, I think, in November of 2016. And it wasn't until
yes.
probably 2020 where a larger purpose started to crystallize. And that's when I drafted a mission statement and started working towards formalizing a board. So the mission of Lamplighter Project is really three-pronged. We're trying to encourage whistleblowing activity in law enforcement. And we're trying to do that by removing barriers to reporting, preventing retaliation, and also elevating ethical officers. And that latter part is something I feel we've done quite successfully in the creation of our annual award, which we give, we call it the Moral Courage Award. Yes. Law enforcement officers, almost all of them are heroic, right? They're the ones that run towards danger. They deal with the criminals that no one else in society wants to go after, and they put their lives on the line. But what is much rarer is moral courage. And yes. That's something that is almost never rewarded in law enforcement. Oftentimes when you do exercise moral courage, you're drummed out of the profession. So I've found very few examples of law enforcement officers who have been heralded by their police chiefs for taking an ethical stand. I can count them on one hand as far as what I've come across. So this is very important, and this is something that I plan on doing until police departments recognize their heroes of integrity. And my goal for that award is to one day receive a nomination from a police executive that wants to recognize their officer for their moral courage. So we've given the award on three occasions, and we'll soon start accepting nominations. Actually, our nomination form is available on our website. If people know of an ethical law enforcement officer. And we do try to highlight cases that are more recent, just because we feel that's can be an important way to get a greater media attention on that whistleblower, and also help to buoy them personally. The fight of a whistleblower is often long and drawn out. And it's easy to get discouraged, So I think our award is something that they can look to, and as a sign of hope and an acknowledgement. Whistleblowers are not thanked often. When I speak to law enforcement whistleblowers, the first thing that I'll do is I'll thank them for doing the right thing, because they never hear that in their own agency. I never heard that. I even in a sit down with my department's number one and two brought that very fact up, and there was just deafening silence in the room. They didn't have anything to say. They had an opportunity. The counter perspective is, I just did what I was supposed to do. Right? Should you really be congratulated for that? But I think many other law enforcement officers in that same situation would not do the difficult and right thing.
That's right.
So it is something that we need to recognize and reward in order to encourage that behavior in our agencies.
I totally agree with you. When somebody has the identity of, whether it's like Sarah Thompson, with the Peace Corps, or Austin Handel, both people I've had on this program, who have displayed such moral courage, and these very important identities are stolen from them, taken away, and they're punished. It's an excruciating thing. So I agree with you. Whistleblowers should be heralded and recognized. And this is the big thing going on in the United Kingdom right now, is their feeling is whistleblowers shouldn't get any remunerations per se, a reward program, they call it, because they should just be doing the right thing. Well, when the right thing causes the end of your career, sometimes the loss of your family and financial security, I think it's a bit much to ask that of whistleblowers. And I totally agree with you that whistleblowers should be rewarded. And I'm delighted to see that you've set something up like this, which promotes that. I just am delighted.
Hi, we'll be right back with more of Whistleblower of the Week after a quick message from one of our whistleblower friends. Don't go anywhere.
Hey, this is Austin Handel, also known as Officer Ash on social media and as the Dunwoody Whistleblower and the Vice Chair of the Lamplighter Project. Leading whistleblower attorney Stephen Cohn's latest book, Rules for Whistleblowers, A Handbook for Doing What's Right, is the ultimate guide to blowing the whistle. Rules for Whistleblowers is an easy-to-read, essential tool for anyone curious about whistleblowing. The book lays out 35 rules to help whistleblowers navigate the complex and dangerous world of whistleblowing. Subscribers to the Whistleblower News Network can also receive 35% off a copy of this indispensable resource. Visit whistleblowersblog.org/rules for whistleblowers to learn more.
Yeah, I recently got in touch with a whistleblower from the, I guess he was a Mullen Commission era whistleblower from the NYPD. And he ultimately had to leave policing. But one of the interesting things was an executive from a large Fortune 500 company had actually read about him in the newspaper and set up a meeting with him and ended up offering him a position in his company. And he's had a quite a successful career in corporate security since then.
That's right? Rare.
So
that's rare.
Yes. It's definitely, I think a lot of officers are blacklisted in the law enforcement profession. I've only seen people be able to, you know, reinvent themselves a number of times. Oftentimes they have to start over in a different state, maybe to corrections, and then work their way up. I think our whistleblowers really are excellent officers who are upholding the highest ideals of the profession. Many of them I've come to find in the past have been decorated for their valor, and it's amazing just how quickly the agencies are to dispense with these officers once they speak out against the wrongdoing in their own departments. You know, I was speaking to an officer just last night. Who had been shot in the line of duty on a dynamic house entry, right? And of course, these officers are rightly heralded for their bravery. But a few years down the road, when they call out bad conduct, you know, they're terminated.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. We have seen and interviewed on this program scores of whistleblowers that is exactly what happened to them. You know, they have exemplary records, and when they speak truth to power, boom, they're gone. But, you know, an interesting thing, not only were you in law enforcement, but you're quite the scholar, and you have kind of developed in your research and other things kind of a police code of ethics, and you kind of based it or designed it around the Hippocratic Oath, which doctors take. And I found, and as I read these four key elements or themes, I was impressed with what you came up with. Could you discuss this a little bit? And also, I know you mentioned in one of your articles that you couldn't even bear to look what happened in Minneapolis, flyover country where I'm located, when we recently had our police disturbance here, which reverberates to this day. So could you maybe discuss your code of ethics and what happened here in Minneapolis?
Certainly. So I think what you're referencing is an article that I, an op-ed essentially that I wrote in 2020 following the murder of George Floyd.
Yes.
And it's actually based on a piece that I had written for a policing think tank a number of years earlier, known as, now it's called the National Policing Institute. At the time, it was the National Police Foundation. And I had volunteered my time there as a policing fellow for a number of years. And I had been, I had heard one of the professors at John Jay, a professor by the name of David Kennedy, who had talked about the idea of a Hippocratic Oath for law enforcement. But he hadn't really fleshed that out. What would it look like? And as I began to research about the origins of the law enforcement code of ethics, I realized that it had not been touched in decades, probably 60 plus years. It was very much the brainchild of a couple of very notable policing practitioners and scholars from the early 20th century. One is August Vollmer and his protege, O.W. Wilson. I wasn't prepared to speak on this, so I'm kind of going off the cuff here. I won't be sure if I get all the facts right, but I thought it was really interesting that August Vollmer, he actually said that police officers have a duty to essentially run out the bad cops. At that time, there was no code of ethics. Mm-hmm. And he basically said it was incumbent on the good officers to get rid of the bad. If policing was going to be held as, a respected institution, this is something that had to happen. And the first part of that was getting a code of ethics. Now, I think it probably served its time well for the era in which it came forward, but it hasn't been touched since. And it's very much focused on, the old model, right? I think they talk about the relentless prosecution of criminals, sort of hunting them down, right? The old lawman type of approach. But I think what's important to realize and why that concept of the Hippocratic Oath resonated with me is that I learned through my doctoral studies, right, that even well-intentioned law enforcement interventions can have harmful effects, right, that often aren't considered. And so I think it's really important that we realize that there's a balance that needs to be struck, right, when it comes to policing interventions. And really the overall goal should be this idea of do no harm, right?
Yes.
And adopting a mindset of trying to root out those harms. So I think you have to look at short-term consequences and long-term consequences. And I was fortunate enough, because of some of the research I had done, to be inducted into the Evidence-Based Policing Hall of Fame. And in a piece that I wrote for that induction, I really looked back on my own career and, wondered, when I was out there, was I responsible for causing harms, right, in the lives of people that I had potentially arrested? And I came to the conclusion that it's probably a mixed bag, right? That it was probably a mixture of positives and negatives, but we don't really know, because a lot of our agencies just don't try to measure the impacts of what they do. They just assume that it's effective and it's the best. So it's really about thinking about these law enforcement interventions thoughtfully and measuring their impact in a robust type of way. So I think my graduate education did shape a lot of my opinions about policing and law enforcement, but also is very grounded in being a policing practitioner, law enforcement practitioner, because you have researchers that are so far removed from the field that either the research that they pursue has little to no value, or they just don't understand how departments function, and that can lead them to make assumptions that will undermine whatever sort of findings they have. So I think it's a really unique place to operate, having a foot in both worlds. And,
yes.
And I'm glad to see other people in that space, right, as police officers become more educated. And
yes,
we're actually doing a little bit of research on law enforcement whistleblowers. So I've partnered with an academic, a policing scholar named Natalie Todak, and we're doing qualitative, we've done qualitative interviews with law enforcement whistleblowers and are submitting manuscripts for conferences and publications, because very little is known about the effects of retaliation. Right. We're trying to bring greater attention from an academic standpoint as well.
Right. A scientific standpoint, which is long overdue, I think. But in these days of, you know, people crying out, defund the police, where one out of every three people have a gun, where law enforcement feels that they're under assault, how is there going to be a happy medium, especially with this do no harm, which I totally agree with you. How is that going to go over with the actual law enforcement themselves, who feel they're under siege?
So I do think that there is a bit of a pendulum that operates in society when it comes to support for law enforcement that goes back and forth. And sometimes mm-hmm. there's a necessary correction, right, in both directions. I think we're seeing that now a little bit, the pendulum swinging back the other way, where there's yes. maybe a little bit more support for police. My concern in the aftermath of 2020 was that the public scrutiny of police, in some cases, rightly so, would actually serve to inhibit whistleblowing in policing. There's some research by a scholar by the name of Tom Tyler from Yale. He's done a lot on police legitimacy. He partnered with another scholar from NYU named Heather Berry, and they had done some psychological research, and they found, of course, this is in a laboratory type of setting, but essentially students who were most devoted to their university were actually the ones who were most loyal when they were confronted with evidence of that institution's failures. So, wow. You know, they came to the belief that when you're highly identified with a group, when you learn about that group's injustice, it actually leads to what they call group-serving behavior. So my fear during that time was that the scrutiny of police would actually cause police officers to circle the wagons right. and inhibit whistleblowing. I very much see whistleblower reform, right, as police reform, right? If we want police departments to get better, we need to find ways to get those officers to speak up, those officers that are living and working behind what some people call the blue wall of silence. I do want to take it back just momentarily to our discussion of Frank Serpico.
Yes.
During the Knapp Commission hearings, there was a lot of attention brought forth by the New York Times about this misconduct and graft that was going on in the New York City Police Department. There was I think his rank at the time was maybe chief inspector by the name of Sidney Cooper with NYPD. And he gave an analogy that is rather famous in criminal justice textbooks when you talk about misconduct. He talked about the meat eaters and the grass eaters. Have yes. you heard about these, James?
Yes.
Right. So the meat eaters were the ones that were actively seeking out corruption and mm-hmm. opportunities for graft. The grass eaters were more the people that were picking up the scraps. So yes. as I understand it, back in New York City, right, if you wanted to be given a patrol car to go out on a patrol rather than a foot beat, you essentially had to pay off the officer that was responsible for the assignment. Now, one of the reasons you might want a car is because that way you could make your pickups, right?
From the pad,
right? Well, you would throw the desk officer a $5 or $10 bill, right? And you would ensure that you would have access to a vehicle which you could engage in your meeting. Now, Sidney Cooper, he actually identified a third group that does not get a lot of attention. So circling high above this prehistoric plain of meat eaters and grass eaters are what Cooper describes as the birds. Mm-hmm. And the birds are those officers who see everything that's going on, right? But they don't partake, either because they're in an assignment that doesn't allow them the opportunities for profiting from the job, or their own moral, you know, standards yes. don't allow them to participate. So the real question in my mind is, how do we get those birds to sing?
Yes. And I noticed that you have birds as a motif on your lamplighter project. If you go to your site, you have them coming out of the whistle. Did this have anything to do with the meat eaters, grass eaters, and the birds? Because you have a whole flock of birds, and here's this little bird in the center all by himself. Did that come from that?
No, but I'm going to say that it is.
Okay, because you should say that. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. So what are your future plans, Dr. Johnson? What are your plans for the future? Where are you headed personally and with your nonprofit, the Lamplighter Project?
Certainly. So as I mentioned before, I was able to retire from policing last year around this time. I was fortunate enough, I think, because although my career was stymied, I was able to develop myself outside of the department, which has led to some other opportunities. I was able to move into the space of corrections. So I'm working for a large city overseeing training and professional development, which is really rewarding, and finding out some wonderful things about corrections culture, but also realizing that, you know, there's a need for our work to potentially expand to support corrections whistleblowers, because they see a lot behind, the pillars of stone and gates of steel that does not always make it out into the public light. And there's a lot of injustice that does go on behind the bars. So, you know, although our focus is specifically on municipal and county and state policing, we are what I consider a law enforcement whistleblower organization. So, we do engage, with federal agents from time to time, and also some corrections folk that speak out. So, you know, I would like to see us expand in that direction. And I think eventually one day, even moving beyond the borders of the United States. I know your own organization has been doing some work around the world. Policing culture, just from the nature of the job, I think encourages these types of, this group identity and group behavior that tends to silence wrongdoing. So,
yes,
we've even had people reach out from as far away as, Australia, right, about whistleblowing behavior. So on the other side of the world, we do more immediately have some present initiatives that we're working on as an organization. One of the things that I found is that very few law enforcement organizations actually have whistleblowing policies in place. Back when I was teaching for a private university, I had a class break and I was checking my email, and this university was emailing me a notice of their whistleblower policy, right? And that same night, I was going out to patrol my community by a department that had given me a badge and a gun, but had no whistleblower policy on the books. And I found that only three large cities in the United States actually have police whistleblower policies, and all three of them are under some form of a consent decree, whether that be a federal or state consent decree. So Seattle, Baltimore, and Chicago were the three. So we've actually partnered with some whistleblower firms to develop a model whistleblower policy that we're hoping to launch later this year in hopes that other police departments will pick that up and make that part of their policies and procedures, because we really do believe that this is a hallmark of a professional organization. You know, it's required by law for certain types of, you know, banking and investment firms and corporations around the country. They have to have these in place. And we believe that it's actually going to change organizational behavior when that relief valve is in place, if they have the knowledge that their officers are free to speak up on corruption. They will actively seek to avoid making decisions that are not in the best interest of their communities.
Dr. Johnson, it has just been a delight to have you on Whistleblower of the Week. I am so proud of you and your organization, what you are doing, what you have done. As a former law enforcement person, I just feel that what you're doing is so important in today's world. And thank you for coming aboard. I really appreciate it. I really do.
But wait, you know, it's when you do blow the whistle, I think particularly in policing, your whole professional and social world tends to come falling down overnight, just because of the nature of law enforcement work, shift work. Your world and your social world begins to shrink rather quickly, right? And so,
yes,
a lot of times cops only socialize with other cops.
That's right.
And so we that tends to disappear, those relationships, and it can leave people feeling alone and vulnerable and isolated. And one of the things that our organization has actually done is we've created a peer support group for law enforcement whistleblowers that's on Facebook. So it's a closed group. It's private. We vet people that come in, but it's been a great source of encouragement for many people to let them know that they're not alone. And, you know, when they are in moments of crisis, they have a brother or sister officer, it may be on the other side of the country, that knows firsthand those experiences of whistleblowing. As Frank Serpico says, whistleblowing's not a one-time thing, right? It's a lifelong commitment. And I feel that many whistleblowers, especially those who have walked that difficult road and emerged on the other side, are often stronger for it in many ways, but are looking to give back and help other officers who may be on that journey. And the experience is the same for myself. You know, I think about that officer that's sitting alone in a patrol car on a quiet Saturday afternoon like today, right? That's wrestling with a moral dilemma. And we want to be there for them when they choose to do the right thing.
Well said. Thank you for appearing on our show. And before I leave, I'd like to mention, we do have a GoFundMe for supporting whistleblowers. We ask people to donate to the National Whistle Campaign. You can go find it on GoFundMe. Look at Support Whistleblowers. Donate to the NWD campaign so we can recognize these heroes in law enforcement and in other areas. Thank you again, Dr. Johnson.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you for listening. And please don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe. If you want to read more whistleblower stories, go to www.whistleblowersblog.org. Music by Rachel Kilgore. Editing and booking by Anissa Sheikh and Victoria Thompson. And a special thanks to our sponsors, Whistleblower Network News. Just as hard to stand up tall.
truth is hard.